I'm walking on air, for I've left all my blue days behind. I've learned how to care, and there's love, really love on my mind. I'm the world's most happy creature, tell me what can worry be. I'm crazy about my baby, baby is crazy about me. Mr. Cupid was the teacher, and the reason we agree. I'm crazy about my baby, baby is crazy about me. Parson, get that book, hold it in your hand. Keep a steady lookout, you can understand. It's an A1 combination, perfect he and she. Crazy about my baby, yes, baby is crazy about me. My baby's crazy about me. Here it is, babes. Your license number is 94136.
This is Ink Studs on CITR 101.9 FM. I'm here joined by my co-host Don King, and our special guest this week is Mr. Eddie Campbell. Talking in Chicago. Normally, you're a man of international mystery in Australia. So it's
Yeah, I am. You know, I've never in my life intended to travel. You know, I've been everywhere, but by default, you know, somebody made me go. You know, I married an Australian girl, and she made me go live in Australia.
What could be
you
worse?
You know, Scottish, but my parents moved to England, so they made me come with them to England. I've never actually gone somewhere just for a holiday, for enjoyment. I've always been dragged, kicking and screaming.
Yeah.
Because I like to just sit at home and play with my dog, you know, Monty.
What kind of dog do you got?
He's a big Labrador.
Oh, really?
He weighs 35 kilos, which is a big heavy dog.
Wow.
But he's afraid of coming into the house. He's afraid of stairs. I've got to carry him in every night.
Aww.
Is he getting old?
No, he's only 7 years old. He's got psychological problems.
Oh, like fear.
I have that.
I guess we'll start out by last time we talked, you were wanting to talk about Monsieur Lyotard, but I didn't know what to ask because I hadn't seen it yet and it still wasn't going to come out for another year. So you're very excited about it, so now we can talk about it.
Have you seen it yet?
I have read it. We have both read it and enjoyed it.
It was a black and white copy, so
I wish they hadn't sent that out because it's one of the most colorful books I've ever painted.
Yeah, that's what I guessed from the front cover and back cover. It looks really...
It's full of mock circus posters.
Oh, really? Well, yeah. I've saw the posters, but I didn't realize how colorful
it is. Yeah, every few pages there's a big double page spread, which uses all the typographical niceties of 19th century circus posters.
That's awesome.
So it's quite a colorful and loud book.
It seems like you had a lot of fun doing it.
I did. It's a lot, and I'm hoping people will have a lot of fun reading it. Mm.
Yeah, I did. I enjoyed it actually. It was really interesting, and it got me wondering like how much of it was true and how much, like, after a while I got the idea that that most of it is based on real life, I'm assuming, but elaborated, you know.
90% bogus.
Yeah. Well, the talking bear kind of gave it away for me.
I was talking to somebody yesterday who said that when the talking bear appeared, he was waiting for the explanation for why this bear was talking, and he'd gone on for another 10 pages and realized there wasn't going to be one.
Actually, I wanted to ask about you did this the book with Dan Best.
Yeah.
And what was your working relationship?
And who is Dan?
Yeah.
Well, Dan is actually a lawyer in his regular life. He's a partner in a law firm. He's a very intelligent guy, but he's one of a handful of people I have lunch with once a week.
All right.
And they're all lawyers and bank managers and chartered accountants who do comics on the side.
Oh, really?
So I go into town and I meet all these people with suits. It looks like a really high-powered business meeting. And somebody visiting town was astonished because she thought all my friends would be, you know, scraggly bohemian types.
And you're going for the three martini lunch.
The guys in suits and ties. But Dan, so inevitably ideas come up. Actually, somebody else, one of these guys said, you know, the question, how do you get into comics? He was asked at a convention once, how do you get into comics? And he said, well, the way I get in was I bought Eddie Campbell a drink.
That works well, I take it.
Let's make sure it's a good drink.
Yeah.
So Dan brought most of the heavy information to the table because I'd never heard of Leotard before.
Yeah, either have I, actually. I thought it would be something I'd be familiar with.
Yeah, Jules Leotard was the original man in the flying trapeze. He's the man that inspired the song, that daring young man on the flying trapeze. You know, he flies through the air with the greatest of ease, that daring young man on the flying trapeze. He inspired a very popular music hall song of his day. And he was the Elvis of his period. He was beloved, you know, by the ladies.
Oh, really? Like a Bo Burnley type guy.
Yeah, and he was the first man to wear the skin tight costume on stage, because all the circus was on stage in those days. They hadn't come up with the idea of putting it in a tent and taking it around the country.
Mm-hmm. It was more vaudevillian, I guess, at that point.
Yeah, that's right. It was very the circus as we know it today hadn't evolved. So circus performers kind of did it, you know, did their acts wherever they could before they were all corralled together as you know, the traveling circus in the tent. But he filled his costume very well, apparently.
Yeah, you used that in there, I noticed.
Yeah. The only problem was, before we'd really investigated who he was, we had this idea of doing a Forrest Gumping our way through history.
Mm-hmm. You do that a bit.
Yeah, you know, we started during the siege of Paris, and later we've got the Buffalo Bills performance in England, and we've got the Jack the Ripper murders, and you know, all the way up to the sinking of the Titanic. But when we actually investigated the facts, we found that our guy Leotard died in 1868.
Oh.
at the tender young age of 28.
Oh, really?
Which makes him more like the James Dean of his period.
Yeah. Wow.
So we weren't sure how to handle it. It was like our whole plan suddenly fell apart. And we came up with this idea of having his nephew impersonate him. So he dies on page 12, and then for the rest of the book, it's his much less interesting nephew who's the protagonist. So there's something of a secret identity thing happening there. He wears the false mustache and pretends to be Lyotard, which fits in with our other major thesis, which was, it was the whole thing was inspired by something I read in, I think it was Will Eisner said it, or Michael Chabon, or it may have been a conversation between the two of them. But he said that all of the comic book characters of our day have their prototypes in the old circus.
Mm. Yeah, that's true.
Therefore, I mean, it takes, so I put it to the test, and I thought, well, they take, for instance, the Fantastic Four.
Yeah, you get the Indian Rubber Man and the Fire Eater.
The India Rubber Man, the Fire Eater, the Strong Man, mm-hmm. and the girl who disappears in the Magician's Cabinet.
Mm. Yeah, I never thought of that.
So this was the nucleus of the idea for the whole thing. And then again, once we had to do the secret identity, this was just playing into our thesis.
Yeah, I guess it's sort of like Bacchus is like a sort of your idea, like your version of sort of a Thor take with somebody rewriting mythology. It's almost the same type of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, and then, and of course, the mutants are the sideshow freaks.
Mm-hmm.
So every, you know, I found that every modern day comic book type, I could find a circus prototype for. It really works right across the board with Lyotard as the flying man. You know, there's always a flying person in the modern superhero group, isn't there?
Yeah, there's got to be one.
There's got to be one. Sometimes they have three or four, which I think is far too many. You can't you can't have more people in the air than on the ground.
Yeah, it becomes too common.
It's all wrong.
Yeah, it takes the thrill out of it.
That's being greedy.
Now I was wondering about this book is all in. Did you use watercolor?
Yeah, it's all in very bright, cheerful watercolor.
Yeah, it reminded me of like just the couple of the pictures I saw. It reminded me of sort of a Renoir thing. I was wondering if there's any. Inspiration for that.
My real inspiration right from the very beginning has always been the Impressionist painters.
Mm-hmm.
Renoir and Monet. I talked a little bit about that, I comic a little bit about that in my book After the Snooter.
Mm-hmm.
When I was young, I used to go out and paint out in the fields and the woods and on the beach, trying to capture the effects of light with liquid colors. It was that was always my obsession, my first enthusiasm. So it's interesting you say that.
Mm-hmm.
It's only in the last few years that I've had a chance to do comics in color. For like 20 years I've worked in black and white, and finally it was with that Batman book, strangely.
Mm-hmm. The ten Knights of the Beast or whatever it was.
The Order of Beasts.
Order of Beasts, that's what
the Order of Beasts. Yeah. That I finally get a chance to work in color, and each year since then, I think it's 5 years now, I put out a color book.
Yeah, I like it. It's just like, I mean, I wish the promo copy was actually all in color, because I think it would have been 10 times more grabbing, you know.
Yeah. Oh, well, I was mad at them for sending out the black and white. I said, "What the hell are you doing?
Yeah.
This book has to be seen in color. They're going to get no idea of what it's like if you send a black and white one."
Yeah, you can't get subtle colors in black and white. It doesn't. Everything's
subtle.
A washy gray. It doesn't quite thrill.
So the palette on this one is completely different from the previous, which was all gray. The Black Diamond Detective Agency,
mm-hmm.
which was grays and ochres, with an occasional eruption of bright red.
Yeah,
I think a book should have its own color character.
Mm, yeah,
and I think about that before I start in.
Yeah, because I got the impression just from the. Just from the cover that it was that Renoir-y, you know, 1880s look to it.
Yeah.
George Seurat, you know, that those types of things.
Yeah, he was, he did many circus paintings.
Mm-hmm.
One feeling I get from the book in comparisons to pretty much the rest of your work is that it's one of the more, and I want to make sure I'm using the term right, like it's lighter in the sense that it's a more optimistic book.
More whimsical.
Yeah. Was that a nice change for you, or?
I think that's more my style, actually. My nature is more that way. Something like From Hell goes completely against my nature.
Yeah.
I don't know why they hired me for that book. I think because I hate horror. To me, horror is
depressing.
It's evil. Because I always felt that the basis of horror, the essential motive in horror is that evil wins.
Mm-hmm. Or the fear that it's going to win or something.
Yeah. Horror is a kind of topsy-turvy version of reality where evil wins. I'm sure you can find a sound theoretical and psychological explanation for why we like this in our world, you know, a literature in which evil wins. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't appeal to me. It doesn't fit with my view of the world. Horror is a pessimistic literature.
That's true. Like the autobiographical based stuff that you do, it always has that edge of, even though like a situation will be fairly serious, there will always be something to kind of lighten it a bit, you know, to keep it human. And
like using a cock ring to fix a sink.
Yeah, so to me, I'm my life, my work. If there was one word or one double-barreled word to describe my work, it would be life-affirming.
Mm-hmm. No, it's true. I just love you. I think most people that have read From Hell, I think that that's a lot of people's introduction to your work, I guess, because they check out the Alan Moore big deal that they made the movie of, and I don't think they ever really get to see how good your stories are when you just write your autobiographical stuff, and it's whimsical and interesting and funny, you know. I just love this stuff.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, the part of the darkness I was referring to is just so I can justify myself beyond the From Hell is Bacchus itself is very violent in a lot of aspects, and it kind of shows the dark side to people, I find.
And in a quirky way.
In a quirky way. So that's why I was saying. part of a feeling I get when reading Monsieur Lyotard is you kind of also experiment with doing some reference to like some comic history while you're going through it too. Is that just me, or is that something you're trying to embrace as part of the process of the time? That
well, comics history, you mean the bit at the end with Joe and Jerry?
Well, I think there's that, plus there's also, I think some of the posters kind of felt like some of the old comic stuff.
Yeah.
And, like, even his personal journey or journal as well.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I that's not conscious. That's probably more accidental or subconscious than deliberate.
Because I know comics history is very important to you, so.
I feel connected to the oldest stuff. You know, I bought two books on this trip. One is the big $100 volume of Crazy Cat that...
Oh yeah, the huge one.
The Fantagraphics put out, and the other one is the third volume of Terry and the Pirates.
Oh yeah, I just got the first one. Those are awesome.
They're beautiful. Now that's all I bought this year, and it just so happens that my bag was overweight by exactly 14 pounds,
which would be that book.
By taking out those two, but they are so heavy, like 14 pounds worth of book. I took those two out, and now they're hand luggage. I'll probably leave them somewhere, and I'll lose them on the way home.
Aww.
Yeah, actually, they're going to be coming out with the complete The Art of Noel Sickles, Scorchy Smith book. I'm looking forward to that.
I bumped into what's his name? Dean Mullaney.
Uh-huh.
He showed me the first copy off the press.
Oh, really?
It is beautiful. There's like 80 pages at the beginning, just devoted to Noel's Sickles' his illustrational career.
Oh yeah, he worked for like Reader's Digest and all National Geographic and everybody.
Beautiful illustrations. They've even got fold-out pages so that you can see them in their full size.
Oh really?
And this thing's priced at, I think, $50. I said, you are kidding.
Yeah.
Is not a $50. This is not a $50. This is like an $80 book for $50.
Actually, speaking of guys like Noel Sickles, are there any what were the old, like when you were a kid or whatever, when you were starting to get interested in comics, which creators grabbed you the most? Like,
well, Sickles, because Sickles is a guy who translated impressionist style into black and white ink.
Yeah, definitely.
So he interested me for that reason.
Yeah, I noticed how much Terry and the Pirates was actually him at first.
Yeah.
once you see what he does, then you go, oh, that's where it all comes from.
Yeah. Yeah, he definitely invented that style, but that style got picked up by so many different people. But but that essential quality of it tends to get lost in the lesser, you know, the lesser masters of the style. Mm-hmm. That real the impressionist eye for how things look.
Yeah, simplifying things.
Yeah.
Were there other comic creators that you really gravitated towards?
I read comic books as a kid, but my real interest after that was the old stuff, and I kept going further and further back, way back into the 19th century, the work of Richard Doyle.
Oh, really?
Who did a book in 1846 or 1850, which was called The Foreign Tour of Brown, Jones, and Robinson. Actually, it was 1856. The Foreign Tour of Brown, Jones, and Robinson, which is a proto-graphic novel, if you like. And I love the man's work. He's totally unknown today. Richard Doyle.
Yeah, I've never heard the name before.
He was late. He became more famous as an illustrator of children's fairy tales.
Oh, really?
But his cartoon work is very vigorous and whimsical.
Yeah, that's funny that it seems like most of the great illustrators from like the late 1800s and early 20th century, they're all children's book illustrators at one point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If I had to explain what I do, very often I find myself on interviews or where I find myself having to justify comic books, you know, the whole American comic book thing.
Oh, yeah.
It really is of no interest.
Bang, pow, let's listen to the Batman theme song.
Yeah, the new big thing that gets my goat is everybody asks about graphic novels. Like, they'll go, do you have the you know, the Watchmen graphic novel, and I'll go, well, yeah, but that's actually a comic book, you know? it's like it seems to be kind of a snooty word now, you know?
Yeah, I used to think, you know, the word would be interesting, but if it just means the same thing as comic books,
yeah.
It kind of bugs me, because I find myself in positions where I've got to justify comic books, and
yeah.
I've nothing against them, they just don't interest me. And if I had to describe the essence of what I was about, I would say that I believe that the great books of our times could, in theory, be written using the elements,
yeah, the medium
of the cartoon, the elements of the cartoon strip, which is much, much older than comic books. Mm-hmm. You know, that goes back over 100 years.
Yeah. Well, I find one case that really works well is anything to do with humor, especially any sort of visual humor. It just, if you have the visual, it's like you use that really well in a lot of your stories, like where it's just like a pause or like a goofy, something goofy happens, and writing it just wouldn't work that way. You know, it's just the way that it tells a story is, it just works well for so many things.
Yeah.
I think the important thing about comics is the synthesis that's created that no other medium can really accomplish.
Yeah.
But we don't need to justify here. We all love comics.
Yeah. That's another thing. Like speaking of that, I was wondering, like, when you, like, you, yeah, I'm assuming you like comic books when you were a kid, but what did you see that made you think I could do these other things with comics? Like, was there any comics that you saw that was, like, that inspired to even get into comics?
There were ideas around all over the place in the early 70s. I mean, I can't remember, there was a famous, was it Updike or somebody, I can't remember, or...
Yeah, he wanted to be famous, a cartoonist, I think.
There was some famous writer or playwright who once said that when the great American novel is written, it could very well look something like Gasoline Alley.
Yeah,
I can't remember who said that.
It could be Updike, because I know he wanted to be a cartoonist, I believe.
Yeah, I don't think it was him. I think it was somebody earlier than that. Mm-hmm. But and there's little things like that. There was this idea around that, and of course the French had got hold of comics in the 70s, you know, with their Cahiers de Bande Dessinée. Mm-hmm. And as always, they had pitched the whole thing onto a much higher artistic level.
Yeah, like Jerry Lewis.
they see things differently. And
yeah.
But all of that helped to create a vision of the potential of what could be done. And I started to develop my own personal thoughts along those lines about where this could all be going. I don't think it's gone the right way. It's not gone the way I had hoped.
Yeah.
But I had hoped that the cartoon strip could rise to the level of great art or great literature. But what has happened is that the culture of our times has descended to the level of comic books.
Yeah, that's true. It's like the lowest common denominator now, instead of being the forefront.
Yeah, like movies. Movies are all talked about in commercial business terms. Like, you know, a character that can be reused as a franchise.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, when did that start happening?
Yeah.
Well, it probably started with Spielberg and Lucas, yeah. You know?
Well, I know they used to do it in the 40s. I know, like, the Ma and Pa Kettle came out of the Egg and Eye and things like that, but those were the rarities. Those weren't the rule, you know? It wasn't like a merchandising franchise thing.
Yeah.
Now, you've got some collections coming out in the future beyond Monsieur Léotard. Am I not correct?
Yeah, next year, my book for next year should be the Big Alec Omnibus.
Oh, really?
We haven't fixed the title for this yet, and I'll tell you why in a minute. It'll be all all my autobiographical books. You know, the King Canute Crowd, Graffiti Kitchen,
The Checkmate. Mm.
Then it'll be actually we're putting it in a chronological order. The How to Be an Artist, Little Italy, The Dead Muse, The Dance of Life and Death, After the Snooter, and then at the end, also The History of Humor.
Mm-hmm.
And at the very end, I've done a new book of about 40 pages, and it's going to be called The Years Have Pence. I've added a new book, which will bring everything up, you know, it'll bring the story right up to the present.
Oh, really?
So it'll be a real, I'm very excited about it. It scanning through it, there's a sense of, it does really cover 30 years of life. You can see people get older and within the pages. So I've organized it strictly chronologically, not in the order it was drawn, but in the order. Yeah. Where you can follow the events chronologically.
I was wondering, like, when you do your autobiographical based stories, is there like sort of a downtime where you muse it, like, or mill over the stories? What am I going to do, or do you do them when everything's fresh? Or?
There's two different modes. There's, you know, something like How to Be an Artist was written well after the event.
Mm-hmm.
That was definitely conceived novelistically. You know, where I knew exactly where this large story was going, and so it runs. It's through composed, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Each chapter is composed, knowing what I'm going to need down the line. You know, setting things up and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And there's another mode I use where I just improvise a daily cartoon. You know, much of After the Snoozer was like that. You know, one page things of overheard, today's overheard funny.
Yeah.
that sort of thing.
Now I've, when you work, I think I read a long time ago that you basically just go right in with the ink. Do you pencil at all?
Well, there again, I have two modes for that as well. I have a very loose style that's done on a small scale, a small page.
Yeah, what are your, like, what size do you work? Like, what size are your originals usually?
Well, on How to Be an Artist, the originals are only about the size of typing paper.
Oh, yeah.
Whereas on After the Snooter or The Dance of Life and Death, the originals are the size that everybody uses. You know, what would be called in Europe A3.
Oh, yeah, like size and a half up or whatever it is.
Yeah, twice up. So I'd have to reduce it 63% to get it onto a comic book page.
Ooh. What about the leotard one with the watercolors?
The leotard's not, the originals for that are not as big, because I knew it was going to be a very small format book.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we call in Europe A5. I don't know what you would call that here.
Yeah, I don't really.
It's like the size that manga's coming out.
Oh, yeah,
Those extra, you know, that smaller than comic book size. So the originals in that are smaller than I would normally do, but not as small as typing paper. Hmm. They're an in-between stage.
What do you normally... this is a little bit technical-y questions, but do you mostly use, like pen and ink, like nibs, or... Like when you do the black and white work?
On the black and white stuff, I used to do everything with a brush way back when I began, so that virtually most of the King Canute crowd is done with a number 3 or a number 2 brush.
Not really?
Except for the lettering, which would be done with a rapidograph.
Mm-hmm. Do you still use those rapidograph things?
Yeah.
I can never get the bloody hang of those things. They just clog up on me.
They get harder to find, too.
Yeah.
With From Hell, I started using flexible nibs.
Oh, really?
So I added those to my armory. I get a much more penetrating graphic with those.
Yeah, well, a lot of it reminds me of that, you know, James Montgomery Flagg or
yeah,
Gibson type of thing, like that little bit of a, it's almost like a brushy pen.
Yeah, Gibson used to actually put his cartoons on an easel and stand back from them, and he had these huge big nibs, and he actually thought of the whole process as though he were painting.
Oh, really? I didn't realize.
So he'd have his pen at arm's length.
Oh, really?
You know, to do those sweeping strokes, they'd be done with the whole stroke of the arm.
Oh,
rather than, you know, a couple of inches away from the, with the eye a couple of inches away from the page, like,
yeah. Well,
I guess the guy was doing it on From Hell. When you're getting things in boxes on a page, you can't range too freely across there. You got to get it inside the box.
Well, I guess that makes sense, because I guess, like, at the turn of the century, if you either had fine art training, or pretty much you would probably have, like, engraving training or something. There probably wasn't a lot of in-between.
So. That's right, yeah. The whole... I know what you mean. The old 19th century illustrators were almost like tradesmen rather than... In fact, that was the whole basis of the academic movement in the 19th century, a little earlier than that, where the academies were trying to raise art to the level of music and literature,
mm-hmm.
because an artist was still considered an artisan.
Yeah,
he wasn't far above a tradesman, because he worked with his hands and he got mm-hmm. dirty.
Yeah, and I guess it was at the time it was probably not especially up until the Impressionists, it would be that they were pretty much craftsmen and kind of doing everything. Everybody was working in the same styles, basically.
Yeah,
too.
But that was, you know, it was the late 1700s that movement started to come around, the academies.
Mm-hmm.
That was the whole point of it. Of course, where it went wrong was that they started laying down the rules, and they became the establishment who decided who got to exhibit and who didn't.
Yeah, no kidding.
And it became this whole complicated thing of favors and approvals and so on. The Impressionist painters were really the first group to rebel against that and set up alternative exhibitions.
Yeah, yeah.
Inside streets and in tents out of town and things like that.
Yeah,
as an antidote to the whole academic movement.
Yeah, and I know there was like a few collectors that would put on shows for them, and there was like 10 artists and 3 collectors or something like that.
That's right. Yeah. Because, yeah, the establishment thing was the official salon,
mm-hmm.
which was all, you know, it was tightly run by the guys at the top.
Who are your favorite artists right now? Like, are the ones that you find the most inspiring?
Today?
Yeah. Like, what's grabbing you recently?
In comics.
Or anything.
Art. I've become very interested in the whole picture of Aboriginal art in Australia. Because this has become a huge big thing in the art market.
Mm-hmm.
But the original guys all died in poverty. You know, mm-hmm. this is only in the last 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
They're already within the arena, you know, within the Aboriginal art market, described as the old masters of the Western Desert painters. Who only really found a fame of a sort when they were already aged. They were in their 50s, 60s, 70s. So their fame was short-lived. It only lasted about 10 years before, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
They were all dying. But I've become very interested in just how that happened and who the major figures were, how it came about, and how such an odd thing happened in the modern art market,
yeah,
the modern art world. There's a real art in the world that's got nothing to do with the art market. The art markets are kind of this colossal leech.
Yeah, yeah. They kind of it's like somebody does something interesting, and then they all scramble to do the same type of interesting thing. You know,
but it preys upon something which is real.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's this monstrous skyscraper of a leech that sits on the these little guys who actually were doing something honest and real.
Mm-hmm.
But it's other people who exchange huge amounts of money based on these genuine and authentic little things that these guys have made.
It's funny. I was going to actually ask if there's anything in Australia that you've been
drawn to.
Or that you've been exposed to that you wouldn't have otherwise. I guess that's one.
And the thing about the Aboriginal art is that everything in those pictures means something.
Mm-hmm.
None of it is evident unless you know how to, you know, unless you've read up on the thing and know how to read it. But in modern times, we become so used to painting pictures that don't mean anything.
Yeah.
Here's my bowl of fruit.
It's true.
Something like paintings that mean something. It's something of a novelty, and the world has rushed to it to get some of this.
So are there certain like Aboriginal painters that stand out? Because I know I've looked into different types of, in Vancouver, there's like a lot of native Northwestern Indian art, like the coastal Indians.
Yes,
First Nations, they call them now. And, whatever. Anyway, and after I look through a few things, you start seeing certain artists that really grab you. Is there anybody that's been grabbing you?
I've just finished. I read the there was a biography of Clifford Possum,
mm-hmm.
Clifford Possum Chapeljari. But I love the way they've acquired these odd nicknames. You know, possum.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's almost like the old blues singers, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Blind Lemon Jefferson or whatever.
Yeah.
It has that kind of quality about it.
Yeah.
Or was it Billy Stockman? You know, it's got something of that lovely old quality of it. Because in our modern times, people don't acquire nicknames anymore.
Yeah, you don't get that. Yeah, like Clarence Gapemouth Brown or whatever. It's like, where the hell did that come from?
Yeah. You know, I love those old blues guys. Big Eye Louie.
Yeah.
You know? But in the modern age, we're not big enough or interesting enough to get nicknamed.
Yeah, back then everybody was big something.
I think that's what the comics world's missing.
Yeah.
Nicknames.
Yeah.
How did you get interested in art history? Like, did you take any schooling in art history, or is it just something you've really pushed yourself in researching and just constantly devouring?
I failed at any kind of schooling.
Me too.
not because I'm not interested in learning or in studying. It's just I was always studying something else other than the course at hand.
Oh, exactly. That's what I would do. It's not that I had a problem learning. It's just I didn't give a shit about what they were trying to teach me.
Yeah, I've always followed my obsessions. I don't know. I suppose it's a good thing, but
for artists,
my obsessions never corresponded to the thing I was supposed to be learning at the time.
Yeah, say when you're in your teens, what did you want to be when you grew up? Like, did you have a plan? Was it like artist,
writer?
In my
teens, I'd already decided I was an artist, but not that I wanted to be one.
Yeah, but
in my head, I already was one. And I think that to succeed, you've got to be slightly mad.
Yeah.
It's not just a matter of deciding what you want to be. You actually have to believe you already are that thing.
Yeah.
It's just that nobody else has noticed yet that they have an artist in their midst.
What I was going to ask is, what did your parents think of that, or your friends?
Well, I don't know. My parents... my parents thought I was nuts. but the funny thing is, I think they quite admire my tenacity. Now, the fact that I stuck to it in spite of everything that was pitched against it. They didn't talk me out of it or try to talk me into something else. But I think their disdain was obvious at the time. Although I was the first kid. When your first kid, you're feeling your way. You're trying to figure it out.
Yeah.
You know, and I know now. You know, I have enormous admiration for my parents. I love them.
That's awesome.
I'm going to see them in a couple of weeks. I'm doing this tour where I've done San Diego, Chicago. I'm doing New York, but I'm going to get to England next week. That's the carrot at the end of the stick.
Right.
have I put up with all this shit about living in hotels for 2 weeks? I get to see my parents at the end of it.
Awesome.
Actually, I was going to ask, like, the first time, when you got into comics, who were the first people that you met that were actually involved in comics?
The first people I met.
Yeah,
I met Brian Bolland at college.
Oh, really?
Yeah, way back in 1973.
Well, they just put out that nice book about him last year, that Art of Brian Bolland.
That's
stunning.
A great book, you know, and nobody knows about it.
Oh, I've been telling everybody about it. It's just gorgeous.
It is gorgeous, because Josh of Knockabout, you know, the publisher of the book, was standing beside me for the whole San Diego convention, and I don't think one single person picked up that book. It's a beautiful, gorgeous book. It's got the whole collection of his Mr. Mamoulian strips, which is one of the most interesting things he ever did. Mm-hmm. I think he said in a couple of places that I had influenced him to do that, because his work was always this tight, completely controlled thing, and he was starting to get bogged down with the intensity of concentration to do those things, and he wanted to let loose on some looser, more improvised kind of work.
Yeah, that's funny. I remember seeing an interview with Eric Clapton, and he said that he saw the Band perform, and he said when he saw that, he thought, you know what, I'm done with Cream. I'm tired of farting around. I just want to make songs, you know, just do good songs for a change.
Yes.
But like when you speaking of San Diego, like when
when you first started meeting people involved in comics, or maybe not even first, but like, who did you meet involved with comics that were you were kind of the most thrilled by meeting, like that you were the most excited to meet?
I can't remember. I suppose it would be Will Eisner.
No, really.
The first time I found myself on a panel with Will Eisner, it was way back about 1990. I told that story in After the Snooter, you know, and Will Eisner didn't know my work, and you know, I said, oh, I can send you my book, and he said, oh, I'd love that, Eddie, because, you know, we'd spoken to each other. I think Gilbert Hernandez was here. Imagine that, me, Will Eisner, and Gilbert Hernandez on a panel, eh? Wouldn't that be interesting? But you know, Will didn't know who I was at the time, and my first big autobiographical book had just come out, my big Alec book, and the King Canute crowd, as it's now called. So I said, I'll send you one when I get back to Australia. And I got back to Australia, and I looked at it and thought about putting it in the envelope. And then I thought, nah. Will Eisner doesn't want to see my stupid book. He's got more important things to think about.
You know what's funny is that...
But I'll tell you what, but sometimes when I was in my cups... And I'd had several ales. I pictured in the back of my head. I pictured Will Eisner going down to his post office at the. He's going down to his post. His mailbox. Going down to his mailbox at the end of his garden, day after day, thinking, still no sign of Eddie's book.
it's funny because I read a thing that Jules Pfeiffer was talking about Will Eisner, and he said that when he was ghostwriting The Spirit, that he would come in like at lunchtime and he would want to talk about the art of comic books, and Eisner would always just say, yeah, we're on lunch. Forget it. I'm not talking about this. Just get the work done. And he really had no interest in comics as art until the 70s, really.
Yeah.
Well, the Eisner shop was a bit of a sweatshop.
Yeah. He ran a sweatshop. Actually, one of the things I was going to bring up, which I can't remember now. Damn it, I was just going to say something and I can't remember. Okay, go on, Robin.
How was it recollecting Alec and kind of exploring your work? Do you kind of see changes you've made and changes you want to kind of re-explore in style? Has it made you, like, reassess your style?
The funny thing was that, you know, something like Fate of the Artist was an exercise in style. I really, the whole thing is a colossal joke, which is an exercise in the construction of the book. And in the one I've just done, the Years Have Pants, which I mentioned way back at the beginning of the interview, I've completely reverted to the old style that I used in the earliest days with all the zipper tones and everything.
Oh yeah,
I really enjoy just coming back to the simple. Telling a funny story in a page. It's like 40 pages of funny stories. And I even remembered anecdotes that I'd never used before. There's an Alan Moore anecdote. I just wanted to go back and visit the simple style of the older autobiographical things after the colossal complexities of The Fate of the Artist.
Mm-hmm. I was going to ask about you said that you're going to be reprinting the History of Humor. That ran an Egomania, didn't it?
Yeah, there was 27 pages of it, mm-hmm. And it's unfinished.
Yeah, so are you finishing it for that?
But I did this little thing that acts as an appendix, which is going to be in there in Diana Schutz's anthology for Dark Horse, which was called Autobiographic.
Mm. Yeah, I love that book.
But it was a little four-pager called I Have Lost My Sense of Humor. which kind of explains why I didn't finish The History of Humor. It's just that I ran up against a brick wall and I thought, that's it, I'm done. And here's why I'm done. I'm finished to that. I was just trying to do these hugely complicated things. It was actually supposed to be quite a complex book where it was going to take place inside my head rather than in the narrative
linear reality that goes on outside my head.
Yeah. It's sort of a train of thought jumping around.
The train got derailed.
Yeah. Actually, I was going to ask about the Egomania magazine. I was going to mention that the Alan Moore interview that you
yeah.
in the second issue, whatever, I remember reading that and thinking, I hope he doesn't talk about magic. I want to hear about comic books. And then I read the interview and I thought, I want to hear talk more about this magic stuff. This is absolutely fascinating. You know, I love that interview. It was so good.
Yeah, if anybody's interested in that interview, the fellow we were talking about a minute ago, Josh of Knockabout,
uh-huh.
Who did the Bolland book,
mm-hmm.
he also did it's a lovely book. It's available in hardback. It's called A Disease of Language. It's got the whole 32-page interview that I did with Alan.
As mm-hmm. well as the Birth
and
Call.
It's teamed up with the Birth Call and Snakes and Ladders, my 48-page adaptations of Alan's magical performance works.
Yeah, those were really awesome, you know. I actually had a hard time trying to listen to the Snakes and Ladders thing. We got an audio version of it, and I was like, I can't do it. But I love the book so much.
You know? That's why I thought, you know, after when he brought the Birth Call out, I thought, this is wonderful, but who's going to listen to it?
Yeah,
I thought there ought to be a printed version so we can follow it.
Yeah, that was fantastic.
But once I thought, I was thinking just a printout, that somebody ought to just print out the text.
Yeah.
You know, so you can follow it in words. And then I thought, well, if we're going to print out the text, well, I wonder if it's possible to illustrate it and actually do it as an illustrated book. Oh, and that was what started me off on that.
Yeah, that's...
I think it's the best thing he ever wrote.
Oh, I thought that was awesome.
Yeah.
I love the more personal people... like it's I've heard it before where somebody said the more personal something is, the more universal it becomes.
Yeah, that Birth Call is certainly the most personal thing Alan ever wrote. There are elements of autobiography in there, you know, how it begins with the death of his mother. You know,
yeah.
He's holding he's cradling his mother in his arms at her deathbed.
It's certainly
the most personal thing Alan Moore ever wrote.
Yeah, that was really nice, actually. I really love that thing. I got to get some of those because I work in a comic store. We got to get some of those things.
Yeah.
So there's all these things I keep telling everybody about these things that they'll never read, you know, like Cordo Maltese and, you know, just or Miracle Man, you know, or Marvel Man or whatever it was called, you know, like these things that I keep telling them, we got to read these things and then we can't get them.
Oh, you can get the Cordo in French.
Yeah.
Or Italian. I can't remember which one.
Italian.
In Italian. So what else do you have going on, Eddie?
we're turning my autobiographical comics into a TV show.
Oh, really?
I forgot to mention it.
Where's that going to be?
There's a couple of... Well, it's in development at the moment, which means we've signed contracts and we've got some development funding.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, so I've actually got a little bit of money just for... But there's a couple of producers in Brisbane approached me. They'd seen The Fate of the Artist, and they thought... I think they'd also seen the American Splendor film.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
And they approached me, and I think they see me something like as an Australian Larry David.
Yeah.
Curb Your Enthusiasm. You know?
It's almost like a reality show.
Yeah, but I don't know whether I'd actually be a play myself in it, but I would be I'd be in it somewhere as the cranky author, you know, who turns up and complains about the way they're doing it. The cameras will suddenly grind, a metafictional thing. The cameras will suddenly grind to a halt, and the cranky author will come in complaining about it or something. We're trying to work out a way of doing it. At the moment, we've written the script. We've written the script for the first one over and over, and I'm just glad I'm over here because it's gone through another rewrite now, and I'm glad I don't have to.
There's nothing you can do.
Yeah.
If it's got to be changed, I'd rather somebody else do it. You know?
Yeah,
but it's kind of exciting just to try and adapt the ideas to that medium. If and when it flies, it would be a. And I'm certainly hoping it does. I'd love to be working in that over the next year because it'll be a bit of live action with a bit of animation.
Oh, that's cool.
And it'll be a series of 8 half-hour shows.
Oh, nice. I hope we can manage to find it some way here.
Yeah. See, that's the difficulty is taking, you know, it's based on the Brisbane books, you know, after the Snooter mm-hmm. Fate of the Artist. But the challenge is to actually find a 30-minute episode, a TV episode in among that material, because mm-hmm. there's nothing there that really says that this is a 30-minute. So I've got to take this and that idea, find bridging ideas, even invent new stuff to make it work.
Oh, really?
So it's going to be something completely fresh. You might see scenes in it that you've seen in the books, but otherwise it's going to be a fresh and different experience.
Yeah, like the Hellboy movies.
Yeah. Just like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're not a movie crew.
we'll get some Nazis in there.
Yeah.
Some apocalyptic visions or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. Brisbane's gonna burn.
Yeah, you're the one that destroys the world. That would be pretty cool.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Eddie.
Excellent. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Robin and Michael.
Don.
Sorry?
Don.
Yep.
Yeah,
I wrote down Michael at the beginning.
Yeah.
You changed that, did you?
Yeah.
I wrote it down because I always do these interviews and I thought, but it comes to the after an hour, you think, I've forgotten who I'm talking to.
Yeah, I do the same thing, actually.
That happens in conversations. I go to comic conventions and someone will be like, who are they?
I forget people's name about 4 seconds after I meet them. So
I used to think it was silly. You know when they do these TV interviews and they say and they're always putting the names in. It's funny you should say that, Robin. Oh yeah, yes, Eddie. That's exactly. Oh, you know, and I think now I realize why they do that.
Because they can remember everything.
It's so that they won't forget.
And that's actually something that I should do with the show is the fact that we sit and talk for an hour, but I don't go and we're listening to Inkstuds and our show today.
Yeah.
It's. A fault of mine.
Yeah.
Luckily, most of the time people listen to them in the podcast and they know exactly who they listen to because it says on the file. Yeah. So, thank you so much, Eddie.
Yeah, thanks a lot. It was a real thrill for me, actually. I didn't want to gush too much, but you're probably one of my favorite comic creators of all time. And I love your writing so much. You make it look easy. You know?
Thanks, man. I wish I had a few more. You know, I have readers in every city in the world, but only one in each city.
Oh, don't worry. You've got about 5 in Vancouver.
Yeah. There's about 5 of us, and we're all crazy.
They are. You've talked to Colin.
Yeah.
You've talked to Don.
Yeah.
They're all.
That's half of us.
Thanks so much, Eddie, and have a swell journey.
Okay. Thanks a lot, guys.
Yeah.
Okay.
Take care.
Thanks very much.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye. That was Eddie Campbell chatting with me and Don about his new book. Monsieur Lyotard, as well as actually it's the amazing, remarkable Monsieur Lyotard, and he has an Alec collection coming out from Top Shelf next year. It should be good stuff.
Looking forward to it.
It's going to rock. CITR, up next, Crimes and Treasons.
101.9 FM.
101.9 cable.
You go to my head and you linger light. A haunting refrain. Then I find you spinning round in my brain, like the bubbles in a glass of champagne. You go to my like a sip of sparkling burgundy brew. Then I find the very mention of you like the kicker in a julep or two. The thrill of the thought that you might give a thought to my plea, cast a spell over me. But I say to myself, get a hold of yourself. Can't you see it never can be? You go to my head with a smile that makes my temperature rise, like a summer with a thousand Julys. You intoxicate my soul with your eyes, and I'm certain that this heart of mine hasn't a ghost of a chance in this crazy romance. You go to my head.